From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, Words and Music, we feature an interview with America's poet laureate Robert Haas, who will read some of his favorite haiku. Haas edited a collection of haiku. A new book of his own poems is nominated for a National Book Award. Also, Elvis Costello performs and talks about some of his new and old songs. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. A federal judge has ordered separate trials for Oklahoma City bombing suspects Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols. Federal Judge Richard Mach in Denver ruled McVeigh's rights might be compromised by a joint trial. Trial dates for the two suspects have not been set. The April 1995 bombing at the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City killed 168 people. The streets of St. Petersburg, Florida, are calm today following a riot last night that left 11 people injured and led to the arrests of more than 20 suspects. The riot followed the police shooting of a black motorist during a traffic stop. Bobby O'Brien of member station WUSF reports.
There have been no new fires, no new rock-throwing incidents since 3 this morning. The disturbance in South St. Petersburg grew out of a routine traffic stop Thursday night when police stopped a speeding car. The driver refused to roll down his tinted window. As an officer tried to look in, the car reportedly lurched toward the officer, who then shot several times through the windshield, hitting and killing the driver. The incident is under investigation by the Pinellas County State Attorney's Office and St. Petersburg's Police Internal Affairs. An arson task force is investigating the more than 24 fires from overnight rioting. City officials and community leaders are meeting today in the hopes of maintaining calm. For National Public Radio, I'm Bobby O'Brien in St. Petersburg.
A Navy helicopter on a routine training mission crashed in the Persian Gulf this morning. One crew member was killed, two others are missing. Lieutenant Commander Susan Hegg at the Pentagon says weather conditions were good at the time of the crash.
At the time of the crash, it was 11:15 a.m. local time. It was a normal sunny day in Persian Gulf, and the Navy is investigating as to what happened.
The helicopter was assigned to the carrier Enterprise. The government agency that oversees highway safety says it will take a closer look at airbags. Melinda Penkava has more.
The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration says it has engineers investigating 5 cases of airbags inflating when they should not have. In the 5 General Motors cars, there was corrosion on the control module that determines if an airbag should expand. The carpeting near these modules, under the passenger seats, had been soaked, some with as little as a glass of water, to a more thorough dousing during a car wash. The investigation could in time lead to a recall for repairs if the part is found to be defective. A spokesman for General Motors says the company has not decided if there was a defect that could harm passengers. GM, he says, has told the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration that the module is not sealed from moisture intrusion. I'm Melinda Penkava in Washington.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 13 points in moderate trading. This is NPR News. General Motors says it might be another 3 weeks before all of its workers are back on the job at plants in the U.S. and Mexico. This follows the strike by GM's union workers in Canada, who this week ratified a new 3-year contract. The strike in Canada triggered a shortage of parts. The automaker says it'll be mid-November before its 33 parts plants in the U.S. and Mexico will be back at full production. Among the plants temporarily closed is GM's facility in Lordstown, Ohio. 5,000 workers are off the job there due to a lack of Canadian-made parts. The United Nations has issued a special report that criticizes the use of torture in Pakistan. Owen Bennett-Jones reports from Geneva.
In a hard-hitting report, the UN Special Rapporteur, Nigel Rodley, said that torture in Pakistan is most commonly used to secure confessions and as a means of extorting bribes. He said the use of torture, especially in the investigation of political cases, was facilitated by the existence of numerous law enforcement bodies which transfer suspects from agency to agency and from place to place. He said this state of affairs is perpetuated by the virtual impunity from criminal sanction of the perpetrators of torture. He said it's essential that in the future the judiciary exercises its responsibility for monitoring conditions in the overcrowded jails with the same zeal with which it's prepared to send people to prison. For National Public Radio, this is Owen Bennett-Jones in Geneva.
With the election now just a week from Tuesday, President Clinton and Republican Bob Dole are doing more campaigning today. The president is in Georgia, where he's expected to call on Congress to assign 100,000 college students in work-study programs to be reading tutors for young children. Dole is campaigning in Texas and Arizona a day after he called on Americans to wake up. Dole said the president's record should get him voted out of office in a landslide. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. America's current poet laureate, Robert Hass, is not only a great poet, he's a great teacher and translator. His love of language is contagious. Hass edited a book of haiku by three Japanese masters. Most of those haiku were translated by Hass. A new edition of that book was recently published by Echo Press. And Echo has just published a new book of Hass's own poems called Sun Under Wood. It's been nominated for a National Book Award. The winner will be announced in November. Hass is the first poet laureate from the West Coast. He teaches at the University of California at Berkeley. I spoke with him last April at the tail end of the first ever National Poetry Month. As part of the celebration, Hass had organized a series of readings by nature writers. I asked Robert Hass to recite a poem by one of the writers he was working with.
There's a poem that sticks in my mind because when I was growing up in, when I was in high school, I guess, in California, Gary Snyder, no, I guess it was in college, who was then one of the famous young beats, caught my attention. It was someone who got the rhythms of my particular world. This is a poem called Marin On, about Marin County, where I grew up, and it was like a haiku. Down valley, a smoke haze. 3 days heat after 5 days rain. Pitch glows on the fir cones. Swarms of new flies. I didn't know that something like that could be a poem, you know.
Why didn't you think that could be a poem?
Well, I guess I still had the idea that it was supposed, that there was supposed to be an agon, a wrestling match at the center of a poem, that some subject had to be wrestled to the ground and its meaning rendered. And the absence of that in this poem, which is, of course, often there in the haiku too, and in the poems that I think of the Tang Dynasty Buddhist poets, which is probably more closely related to, the absence of that is the point. You know, it sits you down in being for a second in a way that's startling. And I just love the sounds of it. Pitch glows on the fir cones, swarms of new flies.
You said that you thought the Gary Snyder poem that you accepted for us had some similarities to haiku. You've translated a lot of haiku mm-hmm. into English mm-hmm. over the years. What makes a haiku a haiku?
Well, that's a good question. Issa, who was a 19th century haiku poet, moved back to his father's farm when he was in middle age, and the local lord, Damyo in Japanese, wanted to honor his presence, so he sponsored a poetry contest with some fairly large prize on the theme of new snow. Each haiku has a seasonal word in it. It's a reference to some time of year that usually has traditional symbolic associations. New snow has associations with freshness and cleanness and purity. And so the poem that Basho wrote for this was went something like, writing crap about new snow for rich people is not haiku. In 17 syllables, on the theme of freshness and purity. It's a perfectly correct haiku. I think for most people, the definition of it involves plain language, an act of attention to the immediate moment. In Japanese, it was composed of 17 syllables in a kind of rhythmic units of five syllables, seven syllables, five syllables. And it intended to be mostly absolutely attentive to the present, and it had this element of seasonal reference always.
Would you recite a favorite for us?
Yeah. Well, every Japanese poet had to write a poem at one time or another about Mount Fuji, and the greatest of the haiku poets, Basho, wrote one that goes, "Misty fall, can't see Fuji." Interesting. That was the first poem about not seeing Mount Fuji that got written.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that one.
You've translated a lot of haiku. What really appeals to you about the form?
Well, what appealed to me about it in the first place was just its clear-mindedness. You know, I just loved the clarity and plainness of the seeing. I didn't understand why later I came to see that, unlike most of Western poetry, it's not a theistic, it's not trying to read God's hand in creation. Not that I don't like this tradition, I love this tradition, but if you think about two New England poems, one that I love that's appropriate this time of year is Robert Frost's Nothing Gold Can Stay. Nature's first green is gold, her hardest hue to hold. It's only so an hour, then leaf subsides to leaf. So Eden sank to grief, so dawn goes down to day. Nothing gold can stay. That poem, which begins with this, you know, very specific observation that the first fuzz on the bare woods in early spring is a kind of sheen of gold, then goes on to moralize it in a specific way.
Right.
I think another great example of this tradition, it's really a tradition of New England Protestant inwardness, I think, one of the great poems in American speech is Emily Dickinson's Certain Slant of Light. You know, there's a certain slant of light winter afternoons that oppresses like the heft of cathedral tunes. Heavenly hurt it gives us, we can find no scar, but internal difference where the meanings are. None can touch it, any. 'Tis the sealed despair, an imperial affliction sent us of the air. When it comes, the landscape listens, shadows hold their breath. When it goes, 'tis like the distance on the look of death. She starts with that shaft of afternoon light and immediately goes inside to this kind of, shockingly modern, painful...
Inner desolation.
Yeah, inner desolation. And we talk about Emily Dickinson all day, a desolation that's preferable to deadness of feeling. I mean, in that poem, that seems like the two choices.
So in comparing this New England style that you're talking about with haiku is just more purely descriptive, more gazing outward than inward?
Well, I think there's a famous story about Basho that one of his students, Kikaku, came to him and showed him a poem, and Basho looked at it and shrugged and said, "The trouble with most poetry is that it's either objective or subjective." And Kikaku, the straight man, said, "You mean too objective or too subjective?" And Basho said, "No." So... in theory, of course, it's like with that, I think it's true of any great art in a way, in some way anyway, that there's a kind of perfect fusion of the outer and inner in the best of it, wherever it seems to be located. Later, he would write poems that would go, this one has a little title, "At a Monastery." "Late fall getting dinner, we peeled cucumbers, eggplants."
Right, now that seems like... in some way, just such a factual recording.
Yeah. So many times his poems just say, is.
Uh-huh.
Here's being. You don't have to be in torment for it to be real to you. You don't have to push it up against mortality for it to be real to you, because it's always pushed up against mortality.
There's a haiku of Basho's that I particularly love that you've included in your anthology of haiku. I'm going to ask you to read it for us. It's about the summer moon.
Yeah. It's not like anything they compare it to, the summer moon. It's the whole poem.
I just think that's so lovely.
Yeah. The poem, the one poem of his that does this inward turn that I know, I mean, there are a few, actually, but is one that I love, goes, "Deep autumn, my neighbor, how does he live, I wonder?"
Mm-hmm.
I think he could be a powerful psychologist, even in this tiny form sometimes. He has another poem that goes, the famous thing, like the cherry blossoms in Washington, the famous thing about spring in Japan was the cuckoo birds in Kyoto, and people would go to Kyoto to see the cuckoos, so which were Himalayan cuckoos, migratory birds that only hit Japan in the early spring. And he has a poem that goes, "Even in Kyoto, hearing the cuckoos cry, I long for Kyoto."
I like that one a lot, too.
I do, too.
Yeah, that the reality is never quite measures up to.
I don't know if it, yeah, it doesn't quite measure up. I don't know if the reality doesn't quite measure up to, but, or to defend ourselves against a reality, we rehabilitate desire instantly to put ourselves back in our real condition, which is permanent longing.
Yes, right. The real condition of permanent longing. Well put. In your anthology of haiku, you included Basho's death poem. I'm going to ask you to recite that. And what does it mean, his death poem? Did he know he was dying?
Yes, he did know he was dying. And in his last years, he was sort of troubled. He came to feel like he should really be involved in religious practice and stop this frivolous business of writing poetry. And he just couldn't stop writing poetry. The seasonal phrase in this poem is "the withered fields." It means uncultivated fields. The English translations of this, British translations always say moor to distinguish it from crop fields, but it means withered fields. It has a peculiar sense of desolation for the Japanese in the 17th century. And this poem goes, "Sick on a journey, my dreams wander the withered fields." And I think he knew he was dying, and I think that though he was a religious poet and he wanted to come to a sense of peace, he saw himself dying at the end with this machine of longing in him still throwing up images, still trying to make poetry. "Sick on a journey, my dreams wander the withered fields."
That's really beautiful. Now, all the poems that you've recited for us today, you've done from memory.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously there's a lot of poetry that you just carry around in your mind.
Yeah.
Now, did you... I know when I was in school and I was supposed to memorize a poem, it would be work to memorize it. I don't have a good memory. Are these poems that you have worked to commit to memory, or do they just stay with you?
These are, I think, probably they're all ones that just stay with me. There are poems, lots of poems, that I've committed to memory and worked at it. And I believe even with college students, I never teach a poetry class in which I don't ask them to memorize at least three poems. Partly on the theory that what I say to them is going to be like duck off water off a... This is a great metaphor, isn't it? Water off a duck's back. Have you ever heard that one?
No, oh, never.
But that they go, you know, if they go away with the poems, they'll have got what they came for. So I like doing that. And I think that it's how we, you know, it's the ancient way that we made them at home in us.
Right. You know, I figure in a way that, to use a food analogy, if you are, excuse the expression, if you are what you eat,
yeah.
that if you kind of like absorb poems or songs into your body, that somehow they transform you in some small but swell way.
I think so. You know, I mean, one hopes so. Of course, we also incorporate all kinds of awful language in our heads, and then language that is... who knows
mm-hmm.
what purpose? You'll wonder where the yellow went if you brush your teeth with Pepsodent.
That's right.
Is it?
I got a lot of that in my mind.
Though some poets, you know, it was Lew Welch, one of the early beat poets, who wrote the famous haiku, "Raid Kills Bugs Dead."
Wait, who'd you say wrote that?
Lew Welch. You know, he was a comrade of Gary Snyder and Allen Ginsberg.
No, I had no idea.
And he worked briefly for an advertising agency in San Francisco in the 50s, and he is the author of that well-known haiku.
Well, Poet Laureate of the United States, is that well written? It sure stuck in America's mind.
It's great, isn't it? It just says it. Raid kills bugs dead. Now that's my idea of poetry.
Robert Hass is America's Poet Laureate. His new book of poems, Sun Under Wood, is nominated for a National Book Award. This is Fresh Air. I'm often asked what we can do on Fresh Air that we couldn't do on commercial radio. I guess one answer might be an interview like you just heard. Commercial radio doesn't get the big bucks by showcasing poetry readings. But radio is the perfect medium for Robert Hass to share his joy in language. I know some of his observations will stick with me for a long time. You may feel that way, too. This is a national fundraising week for public radio. Your station can only carry Fresh Air if you support the program with a pledge. Thanks. This week, we've been featuring a special series on the history of the blues with our rock historian, Ed Ward. On this final piece, Ed talks about the folk revival of the 60s, the British invasion, and how young Americans rediscovered the blues.
Freight train, run so fast. Freight train, run so fast. Please don't tell what train I'm on. They won't know what route.
There was a time when, if you owned a guitar, you just had to learn how to play Freight Train by Elizabeth Cotton. This grandmotherly black woman was the housekeeper for Charles and Ruth Crawford Seeger, parents of Mike and Peggy Seeger, two of the leading lights of the folk revival, which swept America's middle-class white kids in the early 60s. Overnight, it seemed, there was a thirst to learn about America's native musical legacy, and acoustic guitars flew off shelves as people learned to play like the Carter Family, Blind Blake, and Mississippi John Hurt. Some of these young pickers headed south to see if any of the old bluesmen were still alive. They were. Hurt was farming in Avalon, Mississippi, just like one of his old records had said. Skip James was living not far down the road. Son House had moved to Rochester, New York, but still had his guitar and his memories of Charlie Patton and Robert Johnson. There were also people down there who had never recorded in the 30s, but were willing to do so now, and among them was a mild-mannered man named Fred McDowell. McDowell's precise guitar playing and charismatic stage presence made him a folk festival favorite, and he liked playing with the kids, one of whom was a teenager named Bonnie Raitt, who later went on to record a number of his songs. Over in Texas, some Austin folkies found Mance Lipscomb, a relic of the old songster tradition with a life as dramatic as any novel.
Now I'm afraid the woman she done something she had never done before. She was in the bed with another man, made Fred spat it on the floor. He got mad, he got bang, with his gun in his hand. Fred woman's son coming, went and fell down on her knees. I can hear her crying now, Freddy, spare my life if you please. I know you're mad, you got bang, with your gun in your hand. Freddy meets the policeman with his big gun in his hand. Fred, I heard you done killed your woman, he said. Yes, I'm looking for that man. He made me mad. I got bad with my gun in my hand. Fred said, look at you.
Both McDowell and Lipscomb were extensively recorded by Chris Strachwitz, who founded the Arhuli label in Berkeley, California, to document folk blues. He also sought out tapes from other folklorists like Harry Oster, who had made an important discovery in Louisiana's Angola prison.
Lord, I kid myself on pardon bowl. You know, know I got an out again. Been on the boat 3 times. Each time I was renowned. But our hopes in the good Lord. Lord, have mercy on me.
Robert Pete Williams' abstract songwriting and idiosyncratic guitar playing hinted at traditions long gone and musics that went all the way back to Africa. What the mass audience of folkies did not like, though, was electric music. When Muddy Waters, with a pedigree going straight to Robert Johnson, was asked to play the Newport Folk Festival, although he was one of the greatest electric blues guitarists of his day, he was forced to play acoustic. It took the British, of all people, to shame the folkies into acknowledging the riches at their doorstep. The Beatles may have looked toward black pop, but their rivals, the Rolling Stones, plundered the Chess Records catalog, recording numbers by Howlin' Wolf, Muddy Waters, Bo Diddley, and, of course, the problematic sometime blues man Chuck Berry, along with Slim Harpo and other non-Chicagoans. As a British electric blues revival appeared in the Stones' wake, not to mention the valuable contribution of the integrated Paul Butterfield Band from Chicago, older bluesmen found their careers revived, playing psychedelic dance halls alongside groups with unfathomable names. And so, as the 60s ended, the blues stood at a crossroads, either join forces with the young white audience or remain a slowly shrinking genre, playing to an aging black constituency. Blues remained a component of soul music, though.
I know a little bluebird. I sure wish she would sing for me. I tell y'all, I know a little bluebird. I sure wish she would sing for me. I tell you why. She's been flying around so long. Oh, Lord. I wish she would land in my tree.
Performers like Little Milton stayed popular, mostly in the South, through the 70s, and other blues singers like ZZ Hill and Denise LaSalle charted from time to time. On the other side, labels like Alligator and Blind Pig recorded musicians who found the white club circuit to their liking. People like Hound Dog Taylor, an unremarkable Chicago musician who drove frat boys wild. Whatever the fate of individual performers, though, everyone agrees the blues will never die. It's too much a part of the fabric of all American music, from jazz to rock to soul. It stands no more chance of disappearing than, say, the key of G. It's been around too long, seen too much, and told the truth far too often.
Rock historian Ed Ward, nearly all the music he played on this week's History of the Blues series came from two box sets released by the Smithsonian Institution, The Blues and Mean Old World. Our blues series was produced by Phyllis Myers. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, Elvis Costello plays and talks about some of his new and old songs, and he tells us how the meaning of a song can change over time.
We'll be right back.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Elvis Costello's latest CD, All This Useless Beauty, was described in the New York Times as his best album in a decade. Last June, we invited him back to Fresh Air to talk about it, and much to our surprise, he brought his guitar and offered to play and sing. Elvis Costello has been making records since the mid-70s. His early recordings seemed emotionally driven by anger and frustration, and musically inspired by the roots of rock and roll. Over the years, his music has reflected his interest in folk, jazz, American popular song, and all aspects of rock and roll. He's become one of the most influential and highly regarded singer-songwriters in rock. Let's get started with a track from his CD, All This Useless Beauty. This is Why Can't a Man Stand Alone?
Why can't a man stand alone? Must he be burdened by all that is taught to consider his own? His skin and his station, his kin and his crown, his flag and his nation, they just weigh him down. You know pride is a sin that we tend to forgive, but it gets hard to live when you don't have the love in your heart to begin with. Why can't a man
Elvis Costello, welcome back to Fresh Air. A pleasure to have you back.
Thank you.
This is a wonderful song. Tell me about how you wrote it, when you wrote it.
Well, I had it in mind to write like a big, like gospel-based or R&B-based ballad of this kind with very clear lyrics. And in fact, I didn't know that I was really the voice for it when I came up with it. I had it in mind that Sam Moore might record it, from the singer from Sam and Dave. So I had it in mind to give it to somebody else to really sing it in a very forthright way. And I think it gave me the confidence to speak very clearly in the lyrics of the song, in a way that I hadn't always done when I had to sing them myself. So a few years later, having sort of thought about the song and kind of plucked up the courage to sing it vocally, I mean, in terms of the music I'm saying now, not what it was saying, I found that I did have the confidence. I found the right voice on the record for it that wasn't too strident, that softened at the right moments in the story.
Why did writing for somebody else bring out new things in your songwriting?
Well, you can't afford to play with any ambiguities the way you can. I like the little nuances of meaning. I often bury in songs things which may be obscure to other listeners, but their particular personal references. Well, of course, unless you explain everything about your feelings and all of your thoughts, when you hand a song over to somebody else, I think it's essential that it's in clearer language. I like to play with the meanings and sometimes twist the meanings of songs so that I start out with it meaning one thing and then it changes, I go from one position to the next. But when I write for other people, I tend to make myself much clearer because, obviously, they're not me. They can't get it. You know, they can't get in my head and know what I'm thinking from moment to moment, know how I might inflect a line.
You were saying that in a lot of the songs you've written for yourself, the meaning of the song changes as the song goes on, and that the song is most meaningful to you because you know all the subtleties of meaning in those lyrics. Can you think of a song that really illustrates that example?
Well, sometimes it's something comical, you know, like how a song may change over time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I started out with my first album, had a song on it called The Angels Want to Wear My Red Shoes, mm-hmm. which was about getting older and about slipping into the things that you always told yourself you wouldn't do as you got older. Well, the opening line is, I used to be disgusted, now I try to be amused. Well, when I sang it when I was 22 and I wrote it, 23 when it came out, I sang it with the anger of that youth, you know? Now, inevitably, there's a degree more acknowledgement that I've been both right and wrong in the time in between. And a more, perhaps, personal example is a song I've only just started doing recently on this last tour I've been doing with Steve Nye around the country, where we've been playing some of these songs.
the second verse of the song. It's called a song called Men Called Uncle, and it's about a man saying to his girlfriend, you know, well, you're going to go off with these older guys, there's no doubt. Well, of course, I was a young guy when I wrote it, you know. And the second verse goes, ever say you're the one, do you think that I'm serious? You get that kind of talk from older men. If I say I love you, then I must be delirious. So why are you trying to put my temperature up again? You see, I mean, obviously when I wrote that, you get that kind of talk from older men, it was me looking forward. Whether I like it or not now, that sounds funny because I am an older man now.
Right.
So at least to some of the audience, thankfully. You know?
As our listeners have heard, you've brought your guitar, and I'm delighted that you did. I'd like you to play something, if you could, from the new album, maybe the title track, All This Useless Beauty.
I wrote this song I started it, at least, in Florence in Italy. I was spending a month there, and I was very lucky because I spent a lot of time in galleries and churches and all these places with beautiful paintings, and spent the kind of time that modern people usually are not allowed with works that were obviously painted or sculpted for contemplation. And I also spent a lot of time watching people looking at them, whether or not they glanced at them and ticked them off on a list and moved on to the next thing, or whether or not they came in and had their own thought with them. And on one occasion, there was a woman who was looking at these beautiful, idealized statues and paintings, and then looked down at her husband, who was a less than perfect late 20th century model human, and started this song. It's a time such as this, she would be tempted to spit if she wasn't so ladylike. She imagines how she might have lived back when legends and history collide. So she looks to her prince, finding senses so charmingly slumped at her side. Those days I recall on the gallery wall, and she's waiting for passion or humor to strike. What shall we do? What shall we do with all this useless beauty? All this useless beauty. Good Friday arrived, the sky darkened on time, till he almost began to negotiate. She held his head like a baby and said, it's okay if you cry. Now he wants her to dress as if you couldn't guess. He desires to impress his associates, but he's part ugly beast and Italian deceased. So she finds that the mixture is hard to deny. Cosa potremmo fare con tutta questa bellezza, con tutta questa bellezza inutile. All this useless beauty. She won't practice the looks from the great tragic books that will lay to disgrace to face celluloid. It won't even make sense, but you can bet if she isn't a sweetheart, a plaything or pet, the film turns her into an unveiled threat. Nonsense prevails,
modesty fails. Grace and virtue turn into stupidity. While a calendar fades, almost all barricades to a pale compromise. And our leaders have feasts on the backsides of beasts. They still think they're the gods of antiquity. If something you missed didn't even exist, it was just an ideal. Is it such a surprise? What shall we do? What shall we do with all this useless beauty?
Elvis Costello, thanks so much for performing that. And that's the title track from Elvis Costello's new record, All This Useless Beauty. We're going to take a short break here and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Elvis Costello. When Chet Baker recorded your song Almost Blue, did he and the musicians who he played with change any of the harmonies on the song?
Well, the accompaniment is so sparse, it's very hard to hear any of the harmony. I mean, it's a pretty much a found melody, you know? I mean, Chet Baker sang The Thrill Is Gone like this. The thrill is gone. The thrill is gone. You know, it's just like that. It's like a plain vibrato-less, like just plaintive tune.
And The Thrill Is Gone is the song that inspired in part... Baker's version of The Thrill Is Gone inspired in part your song, Almost Blue.
Yeah, Almost Blue. And I mean, you can hear the similarities, yeah. Almost blue. Almost doing things we used to do. There's a girl here and she's almost you. Almost all the things that your eyes once promised, I see in hers too. Now your eyes are red from crying. Almost blue. Flirting with this disaster became me. It named me as the fool who only aimed to be almost blue.
it's almost touching, it will almost do. There is part of me that's always true, always. Not all good things come to an end now, it has only a chosen few. I have seen such an unhappy couple. Almost me, almost you, almost blue.
Gosh, I love that song. I really like the way you did it, too. That was just wonderful. You wrote Almost Blue with Chet Baker in mind, because his recording of The Thrill Is Gone kind of inspired your song. How did Chet Baker get his hands on your song and record
it
himself?
Well, I gave it to him. I gave him a copy of it. He came in to play on a record of ours called Shipbuilding, which was a very unlikely song. It was music by a friend of mine, Clive Langer, and words by myself. And it was written during the Falklands War. And I heard a plaintive voice, and I didn't really know who I wanted. You know, I mean, my absolute ideal of the record was Miles. And I didn't think in a million years I would be able to get Miles. And by sheer chance, like, we no sooner started recording, but I opened the paper one day, and Chet Baker, who was a very elusive character and very rarely kept to any kind of predictable schedule, usually scheduled dates at very short notice, suddenly appeared in London. He hadn't played in London in about 15 years. And the very week we were recording, he turned up in London, playing a little club date. And I went along and introduced myself, and he had absolutely no idea who I was, except I was one of the more polite people in the club, you know, that was a very, very noisy club, full of jazz critics talking, ordering drinks at the tops of their voices, you know, and giving him absolutely no respect. And I said, would he come down and play a session? And he turned up the next day with his trumpet and played this trumpet solo. And at the end of it, I gave him a copy of the record, Imperial Bedroom, which contained Almost Blue, which was the previous record we'd made, mm-hmm. and said that I'd written it with him in mind and perhaps he'd like to listen to it. And a few years later, I heard a rumour that he was doing my song. But although I had seen him several times in the meanwhile, he had never mentioned any interest in the song. And although I had given him a copy of the record, he never mentioned it, and I never pressed him on it. And shortly after his death, somebody told me that he had recorded it, so I didn't hear his version until after he died.
Do you think your singing has been influenced by Chet Baker's singing?
Not really, because I sing with a very wide vibrato. I try to keep it under control. Sometimes I do try and just kill it completely. I've got a strange vibrato. Which, when I'm tired, it comes out very broad. And I start to take on more like a Billy Eckstein type of vibrato, but I don't have that kind of rich voice. I might, you know, my voice. I have a much bigger range than people think I do. I've got quite a wide range. You know, it's from two octaves below middle C F to top B flat. So I can't use all of those confidently, all of that area confidently. And the middle register is the warmer, and the upper part is very loud and obnoxious, as you've already heard. But it can be very exciting in the right kind of song. I've tried to listen to all the singers. I mean, lots of different singers have influenced me, but I don't sound like any of them. And I've listened, you know, with great attention to Sinatra and to Billie Holiday, but equally to Van Morrison, Rick Danko, mm-hmm. And numerous other people. And people that people would never think in a million years that I've listened to avidly, like Joni Mitchell, who obviously I don't sound anything like, but has been very influential. And one or two songs on this record, I think, compositionally have some owe some debt to her writing, you know.
Elvis Costello recorded last June. His latest CD is called All This Useless Beauty. You can also hear him on the soundtrack to the movie Grace of My Heart. This is Fresh Air. This is a national fundraising week for public radio, and we've rebroadcast our interview with Elvis Costello because so many listeners told us they wanted to hear it again. I particularly enjoy our performance programs with singer-songwriters because it's a chance to hear the stories behind the songs and then to hear the songwriter do those songs solo in an informal setting. Our guests are very generous in sharing their talents. During this fundraiser, we're hoping you reciprocate by making a pledge. In order to keep Fresh Air on the air, your station needs to hear from you now. Thank you. This Sunday, CBS presents a new police drama called Easy Streets, starring Ken Olin of 30-something. Our TV critic David Bianculli calls it the best new show of the fall season.
Other than just flat-out begging you to watch this show because it's so good, I'm not sure how to start out talking about Easy Streets. But here goes. If you're like me and you're still upset that CBS canceled Due South, all you need to know is that the creator of Due South, Paul Haggis, is also the guy behind Easy Streets. If you're not a Due South fan, which probably means you never saw it, the best way to describe Easy Streets is to make some more familiar comparisons. Ken Olin stars as a cop who winds up going undercover to investigate a young mob boss, a bad guy who gets almost as much screen time as the good guy. In that way, Easy Streets is a lot like the first season of Wise Guy. The stories of the police and the crooks sometimes run parallel and sometimes intersect. In that way, Easy Streets is a lot like Crime Story. It's got photography that makes it look like the French Connection in some places and Apocalypse Now in others. And it's got dialogue that sounds like King Lear in some places and Pulp Fiction in others. I've seen the first two episodes, and they're terrific. The script is amazing, and so is the cast. Olin, as the cop, establishes the depths of his character's isolation almost immediately. Jason Gedrick, the eventual prime suspect from last season's Murder One, plays an ex-con drawn into the mobster's web. And Deborah Ferrantino plays a savvy and sexy lawyer who's already there and likes it. All of them are just right. The scene stealers, though, are Rod Steiger in a brilliant one-shot guest performance, and, as the show's evil yet charming antagonists, Joe Pantoliano and Mike Starr as mobster Jimmy and his sidekick Mickey. Sometimes these guys are appallingly ruthless. Other times, as in this scene from episode 2, they're appealingly goofy.
Mickey. Huh? When was the last time Dogface paid his vig?
Which one's Dogface?
The one with the face like a dog.
Oh, you mean the guy who squints like this all the time?
Yeah, him. When was the last time he paid us?
That's Johnny One Eye. He don't owe us nothing.
No. I'm not talking about Johnny One Eye. I'm talking about Dogface.
Johnny One Eye is the guy who squints all the time. Thinks it's because he got one eye.
Which is why they call him One Eye. This guy is not called One Eye. He's called Dog Face on account he's got a face like a dog.
What kind of dog? What are you throwing things at me for? You have no idea how many unattractive people you lend money to. What? So now that's my fault?
After this Sunday's telemovie premiere, Easy Streets moves to Wednesday nights on CBS opposite Law & Order and Primetime Live. To me, that choice isn't difficult at all. It's easy.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Swingers is a new independently made comedy about a group of young guys struggling to make it in Hollywood. The cast is made up of unknowns and stars Jon Favreau, who also wrote the script. Our film critic John Powers has this review.
If there's anything I dread having to see, it's yet another picture about male bonding. You know, one of those movies where overgrown boys go out boozing, swap smart-aleck banter, and treat women like baffling creatures from some distant planet. So my heart sank when I heard about Swingers. But this time my dread was misplaced. Swingers is filled with drinking, wisecracks, and sexual idiocy. But it's also a whole lot of fun. Its hero is a struggling stand-up comic named Mike, played by Swingers screenwriter Jon Favreau, whose big nose and great slab of a face make him resemble the old screen actor William Bendix. Mike is a likable sad sack who can't get over his funk at being dumped by his girlfriend. He's constantly moaning about his lost love. Tired of these mopey monologues, his buddies put him on a crash course of bachelor nightlife, driving him out to Vegas, playing drunken video games, and taking him to boho parties where he might be able to pick up women. and they do it all while talking their own special lingo. They keep telling Mike, "You're money," money being the highest possible term of praise for anything. But Mike has a hard time believing that he's anything more than small change. He melts down in the presence of a flesh-and-blood woman. So his pals give him step-by-step instructions on how to score. For instance, what to do when you've just been given a potential conquest phone number.
So how long do I wait the call?
A day.
Tomorrow.
Tomorrow, then a day.
Yeah. So 2 days.
Yeah,
I guess you could call it that.
Definitely.
2 days.
2 days is like industry standard.
No, I used to wait 2 days to call anybody, but now it's like everyone in town waits 2 days. So I think 3 days is kind of money. What do you think?
Yeah, well, but 2's enough not to look anxious.
Yeah, 2's enough not to look anxious, but I think 3 days is kind of money.
Yeah,
you know,
but you know what?
Maybe I'll wait 3 weeks. How's that? And tell her I was cleaning out my wallet and I just happened to run into her number.
Then ask her where you met her.
Yeah, let's go where I met her. I don't remember. What does she look like? Would that be T? Would that be the money?
You know what? Ha ha ha, Mike. Laugh all you want, but if you call too soon, you might scare off a nice baby who's ready to party.
Well, how long are you guys going to wait to call your babies?
6 days.
Although Mike's romantic agony gives swingers its forward momentum, his plight isn't very interesting, really. Anyone who's ever seen a Woody Allen movie is familiar with watching a neurotic comic sink ever deeper into romantic humiliation. Director Doug Liman seems to know this, and he neatly plays up the movie's sociological side, offering a witty sketch of the aspiring young performers who prowl Hollywood's trendiest fringes. By day, these wannabe stars endure dispiriting auditions, wondering if they should take that role at Disneyland playing Goofy. By night, they primp and preen and lie to strangers about how their careers are really taking off. The filmmakers have clearly lived the subculture that these guys inhabit, and the movie takes place in the precise landmarks of this milieu: the Hollywood Hills Diner, the Dresden Bar, and the Derby, where happening types dance to old-fashioned swing tunes. In fact, Mike and his cronies are postmodern swingers who pluck ideas of cool from several decades. The guys wear retro clothing. They borrow stylistic flourishes from Goodfellas and Reservoir Dogs. And they horse around just like Sinatra, Dino, Sammy, and Joey. But unlike the original Rat Pack, which oozed corruption, these guys, ring-a-ding-ding, couldn't be more sweet-natured. Although Swingers is conceived as an ensemble piece, it's effortlessly hijacked by a wonderful new actor, Vince Vaughn, whose real-life friendship with writer Favreau helped inspire the film. Vaughn's a tall, slim, startlingly handsome man with some of Cary Grant's gift for being goofy. He plays Mike's know-it-all pal, Trent, a lady killer who has all the trappings of a cad, but none of the actual caddishness. Whether he's giving Mike romantic tips, trouncing his buddies at video hockey, or seducing waitresses by tipping them badly, Trent is an innocent who fancies himself a cynic. And in his blend of the wised up and the naive, he's the very spirit of the movie itself. Breezy and shallow, but very good company, Swingers is one male bonding picture that's more about charm than testosterone.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.